$1,000. Which is a curious fact when you stop and think about it. And I'm pretty sure that I and some other journalists like me know a lot more about it than any U.S. president has ever known, with the exception of Jimmy Carter. And the reason is they don't like this subject, and they shy away from it. They don't like to sit down for long briefings on the PSYOP. It's tedious. It's highly complex. It's hard to remember. They don't really understand it. It's very dull, and it's frightening. And as I say, with the exception of Jimmy Carter, I don't believe any American president has ever known in any detail what we're actually planning to do in the event of a nuclear war. And I was recently talking to some people in Congress about this, and I asked them, what kind of oversight does Congress have over the war planning process? Congress spends an inordinate amount of time going over the budgetary line items for every nut and bolt on a project like the B-1 bomber. So how much time do they spend listening to the plans for the use of the weapons that they have authorized funds for? And I asked four representatives and four senators, and they all gave me a different answer. None of them knew. They really didn't know. They had no idea what sort of oversight there was. So I asked some further questions. I asked the Pentagon what sort of oversight there was, and they took a long time to answer and eventually sent me a written answer which said, we tell them what they need to know from time to time. That was the essence of the answer. Their wording was somewhat more ornate, but that's what it came down to. I'm not being unfair, I promise. And I asked a lot of congressional staffers what sort of oversight of U.S. war planning process takes place, since the Office of the Secretary of Defense seems to be, at least for the moment, incapable of really looking at these plans and considering their consequences. What kind of oversight might the Congress exercise? And the way I think it works is this, that the chairman of the Armed Services and the Appropriations Committees in the House and the Senate are entitled to an annual briefing on the PSYOP if requested. This is exactly the way oversight of the intelligence community used to be conducted. And that is to say, no oversight of any kind at all. We're talking about something that's very, very complex here. It's like trying to review the plans for research and development for IBM for a year in 90 minutes under onerous conditions in which you're not allowed to take notes. The Congress keeps no records of these briefings of any kind. They do not know from one year to the next what they got told last year. In my opinion, this really isn't good enough. Somebody ought to have the responsibility of determining whether or not we're threatening ourselves with our own war plans. And it seems to me the logical place to begin would be in Congress. They exercise oversight now of the intelligence community. They don't have a right of approval. They don't authorize covert action. They merely insist on being informed about what happens there. And by being informed, taking responsibility for what's being done with their money and in their name. And I believe that some similar procedure ought to be established for annual review and oversight of American war plans to ensure that they're really consistent with our own safety, that we know what's in them, that we've fully considered the consequences of carrying them out, and that we, for once, look it in the eye. And when I think about that, I keep thinking about what General Odom said, that in war, times of tension and crisis, you do what you're organized to do. And what we've organized ourselves to do now is to blow the Russians off the face of the earth in the course of a nuclear war. And we know that if we do that, we will be threatening ourselves. And since that's the case, perhaps we ought to organize to do something different. Now, having said that, I'll try and answer any questions you might have. Yeah?
Just a question I've always wondered about. About this kind of plan. Since the missiles are targeted and they can only have a limited number of targets they fed into them, isn't it going to be, in any real situation, isn't it going to be very spotty, because some of those missiles will be destroyed in silos. Some of those missiles may fail for technical reasons. There must be a lot of overlapping. They must say target 4 or 5 warheads to one target, just to be certain that priority targets actually get hit. This may sound like a silly question. Does the military think we have enough warheads now to hit all those targets right down to all those human institutions that they want to destroy? Or is there still a feeling in the military that the PSYOPs are kind of under-funded, that they need more?
I don't think that they really feel at the moment that they haven't got enough. To some extent, they might feel that they haven't got enough of exactly the sorts that they would prefer to have. There is a lot of overlap. You know, we're talking about 10,000 warheads in the strategic arsenal, and that, you know, maybe a couple hundred cities in Russia with more than 25,000 population, and a relatively small number of targets, in fact. The Soviet Union, the economic life of the Soviet Union is much more concentrated than it is in the United States. And each one of these warheads may be able to destroy more than one target. Basically, what you do is you draw a circle on a target map that has a lethal radius that includes as many aim points, as many things as you want to get as you can within that particular circle. And then you put another one somewhere else. There are all kinds of sort of backward ways of figuring out what are in U.S. war plans. One is a study conducted by ACTA, the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, in 1978 of Soviet civil defense planning. There was a big argument in the defense community at that time about the extent of Soviet civil defense programs and how effective they were. So ACTA made this study to see what would happen in the event of a nuclear war and, you know, how many Russians could be saved by Soviet civil defense measures. And they estimated that 60 warheads would be allocated to Moscow, for example, in the final stages of a major U.S. strike, and 40 on Leningrad, and an average of, I think, 13 on each of the 8 other largest Soviet cities, and on down through the list. So you get a sense there of the kind of overlap that you're talking about. But I don't think that the military feels that they haven't got enough weapons to hit all those targets. It depends on how you define a target. When we first started putting together a national strategic target list, I think there were a couple of thousand targets on it. And it now includes something on the order of 40,000 targets. Basically, the way they've done it, they haven't found 40,000 new things they didn't know about. They divide them down in much finer ways. But you might take one thing would be a railroad marshaling yard, you know, in one target list. And a few years later, when you've got more accurate weapons and you can be more discriminating, you might divide it down into 3 or 4 different targets. You know, this end you got the roundhouse, and at that end you've got, you know, the central administrative building, and some other part you have a stockpile of rails or whatever. And you'd break it down in that kind of way. Or you take a military communication system, and you could look, and from one point of view, it's, you know, it's just a node where there's a lot of telephones, and from another point of view, it's all the substations and things of that kind. So that the number of targets continues to increase to meet the demands placed by available weapons. In 1970, when we began deploying MIRV missiles on our submarines, the people out at the Joint Strategic Target Planning staff initially did not know what to do with all these new weapons. They didn't know how to factor them into the PSYOP, because we already had weapons covering everything we could imagine, but then they just started to work on it a little harder and define things more precisely and more exactly, and they found targets for all those weapons. Yeah? Yeah.
The other reason that's commonly cited for having such an excessive nuclear warhead is that we have to be able to absorb a first strike from the Soviets and a dual strike back, give
exceeded an unacceptable losses. To your knowledge, do you know if the contingency plans that we have allow for retargeting or restructuring of our responses after we sustain the first strike? Or is the basic idea just that we fire whatever is left and let them hit whatever they were aimed at?
Well, it's a little bit of both. It depends on the weapon system that's operating. They do have a retargeting capability, but it's different for each system, and it's changed a lot over the years. I remember talking to a missile man one time who'd been out at one of the Minuteman bases in the early years, and at that time, in order to retarget a Minuteman missile, you had to go out to the missile site at night and pull back the hatch cover and climb down into the silo and open up a little window in the nose cone of the missile, and then you had to align the gizmo inside on a star or a series of stars and realign it in order to retarget it. And this took several hours when you were at the site. And these things, are many hundreds of miles apart. And you may recall these things are mostly in the northern part of the Midwest, and they have a very long winter out there, and it's really rugged. So, most of the time you couldn't retarget these missiles. And if it was a cloudy night, you couldn't retarget the missiles. And so it was a very inflexible system. The first 1,000 Minutemen were more or less had to go at what they were aimed at initially. There was no going back. But later on, they become more flexible. And the Minutemen now are much more flexible, and they can be retargeted from a remote location, by sort of feeding numbers into a console. The MX system is more complicated still. All of those missiles are going to be in kind of constant communication with each other. And basically, they're asking each other periodically, how are you? And all the missiles come in and say, I'm fine, And if one of them comes in and says, or doesn't answer, then the others take account of that fact. And if that particular missile happened to have higher priority targets than some of the missiles that remain, then they automatically retarget to those higher priority targets. It's quite a complex.
Does that happen in flight or before launch?
No, that would have to happen before launch. You can't speak to a missile when it's in flight. And the reason for that basically is if we could speak to it, well, maybe they could speak to it. And so once it's out of the silo, it's really on its own. And then the aircraft, are somewhat flexible. They can change their routes and pick different targets along the routes, and they're in communication with each other, and they have priorities for targets and things of that kind. So there's some flexibility in here, but not all that much, because the real problem is the real-time intelligence rather than the retargeting at the moment. In other words, how do you get current information on what's happened over there? In order to change your plans in midstream, as it were. And the Reagan administration has been spending, as the Carter administration had planned to do, vast sums of money on C-cubed I, command, control, communications, and intelligence, which is essentially wiring systems for keeping control of a nuclear war. Yeah?
I think it was during the Carter administration, it was very ostentatiously announced that the United States is now going to target the top Soviet leadership. Is that still policy? Why? What was the rationale for doing that in view of the likelihood that it would render impossible a negotiation at the end of hostilities? And what would maybe be the response of the Soviet Union in terms of their planning?
The response of the Soviet Union has been to do the same thing. They also target communications and leadership targets in the United States. But when you talk about leadership, as they did, it's easy to think that they mean Gorbachev, but that's not who they mean. They mean the instruments of control in the society. They're not planning to kill all the Politburo on the first day, but what they are planning to do is to make sure that the other side understands that at the end of a nuclear war, the Communist Party, the Soviet Union, will no longer exist, and it will not be in control of the country. Now, who is anybody's guess. And if the nuclear winter scientists are right, nobody. But the Communist Party and the KGB will cease to exist. And so that targeting set was intended to tell the Soviets that this wasn't a case of it'll be terrible, but at least we can squeak through. It was to tell the Soviets that it'll be terrible and there's no way you can squeak through. Now, the Soviets have built a large number of leadership civil defense shelters. And I believe there are supposed to be something like 75 of these inside the Moscow Ring Road. And they're quite elaborate affairs. I mean, they're deep underground and they're self-contained and have water and power and air filtration systems and stuff like that. And we have made it clear to the Soviets, you know, that anybody in those civil defense shelters in wartime will die.
But then who do we negotiate with as far as the end of hostilities?
Well, this comes in the final stages of war. This is when there's nobody negotiating and the shooting is going on in a way that suggests that you know, ceasefire is not imminent. This is not sort of the opening day. This is down the road a bit. How far down the road, you know, is anybody's guess. So that, but the theory was that we needed to refine the nature of our threat so that they understood more clearly what was going to happen in the event of a nuclear war, and to make sure that they didn't misunderstand what was in store. And in many ways, it was a very, there was an air of contempt to some degree, I think, in the way it was expressed by Harold Brown sometimes in speaking to Congress, as if they were a particularly venal group of men, you know, who were only thinking of their own skins, which I, you know, don't believe to really be the case. But there was also that attempt to make sure that they would understand, you know, their society would not survive as it was presently constituted. Yeah?
I've been very interested in the last year on a kind of another perspective on thinking about nuclear war, another perspective from the largeness of things like nuclear winter and many megaton bombs on cities and USSR deterrence theory. And that's the perspective of the smallness of nuclear weapons. Of the 10,000 weapons that you mentioned, I've become aware that there are at least several thousand which are 10 times smaller than the Hiroshima bomb. The comparison is that a single B-52 bomber in 24 hours can deliver maybe 200 tons of conventional explosives. Five of them can deliver 1 kiloton, and that's equal to one small atomic weapon. Can you comment on the use of these 3,000 or so small nuclear weapons, which are not intercontinental at all, are battlefield weapons, and how they relate to a nuclear warfighting plan?
Well, that's hard to do. They don't fit in any very clear way, as I understand it. They don't have the same kind of highly rigid planning in advance that the strategic weapons do. The strategic weapons, I believe, are all larger than the size you're talking about. I know that bombers can carry some munitions that have variable warheads, and you can actually twist a dial on the warhead and determine the size of the yield that's going to be created. But strategic warheads are mostly bigger. But the smaller tactical weapons are really going to be used much more like ordinary military munitions and not in the pursuit of a very elaborate plan as the execution of the PSYOP would be.
Do you think then because it's not an elaborate plan, it's not a dangerous plan, or should it be thought of?
Oh, no, of course not. It's very dangerous, and one of the things that's most dangerous about it is that it, once it started going, it would almost certainly generate pressure to go the limit. Once the chaos of a nuclear war in Europe really got running wild, it would be very hard to keep the Soviet and American homelands sort of sacrosanct. So it, you know, could lead to a global catastrophe in that way, and it would certainly be a continent-wide catastrophe in Europe. There's no question about that. But one of the things that worries me about the PSYOP is that these plans are sort of designed and wired in advance to unfold in a certain kind of a way. And there's no easy way to punch in alterations after they get started. And at the moment, they include plans for these all-out society-destroying attacks, which, you know, it's perfectly possible that the planet couldn't survive. So it has an extra element of horror about it that, you know, I think is worthy of note. Yeah?
I'm interested in the subject of deterrence, and I'm wondering if, or what your feelings are about the value of deterrence before we start employing these crazy war plans that are launching nukes of such tremendous size. What do you think is the value of deterrence, the idea that we have such a force, so don't even launch one weapon against us? Do you think there's any value in that? Is mutual's assured destruction a valid sort of policy?
That's a very hard thing to estimate. I mean, there's no question that these are very frightening weapons, and that everybody that has anything to do with them seems to have a sort of a sober sense that this is not something to be fooled with in a lighthearted manner. And, you know, the Russians show just as much apprehension of that as we do. And the days when Mao used to laugh at nuclear weapons as the weapons of a paper tiger, you know, are long over. The Chinese understand perfectly well what nuclear weapons are, and they themselves do not deal with them in any kind of a lighthearted manner. So in a sense, you know, the fearfulness of them certainly works as a sobering and breaking instrument on great powers that might otherwise go to war. But as to whether or not, you know, they've been responsible for keeping the peace, well, I'm reluctant to concede it, and I'm not sure I believe it. You know, the period of time which passed between the end of the Persian War and the beginning of the Peloponnesian War in 5th century Greece was 38 years. And the suspicion between Sparta and Athens began in a very, very similar way to the suspicion that developed between the United States and the Soviet Union at the end of World War II. Sparta and Athens had been allies against Persia, and when the war came to an end, the Spartans disbanded their army and went home and began to ask themselves, why are the Athenians rebuilding their city walls? And in particular, why are they not disbanding their great naval fleet? They never had a great naval fleet before, and at the end of the war against Persia, they kept it. And it alarmed the Spartans and eventually led to a war. And you know, I look at that period as being sort of the outside of the customary or traditional limit between big wars, 35, 40, 45 years, something in that line. And we're beginning to approach the outside of what is a kind of a natural breathing spell between great political cataclysms. You know, a big war is a frightening thing under any circumstances, and national leaders tend to take it seriously and always have. I mean, sometimes they're dumb and they make mistakes, but for the most part, they understand that a big war against a strong opponent is a very dangerous thing to get into because you can really get beaten. And they don't go about it lightly. And certainly when people went into the First World War, they were much more lighthearted about it than they are now. But if you go back and read the history of that event closely, there are many, many accounts of people in general staff conferences breaking into tears and national leaders wailing aloud and things of that kind. I mean, they clearly understood this was a big deal. It was out of control. It was running away with them, and they had no choice except to go forward, and they were horrified for the most part. Those cheering crowds, you know, that thought they were going to be in Berlin by Christmas and so on, were all in the streets. The people in the chanceries were nowhere near so optimistic. And so my feeling is that there's a natural deterrence between great powers anyway. Whether it needs the added dimension of nuclear weapons to keep the Soviets and the Americans from each other's throats, I don't know. But when the military makes that claim, you know, it seems at least equally plausible to me to say, well, no, it wasn't the nuclear weapons that prevented the war from taking place, it was the peace people. And perhaps it's their doing. Yeah?
What set Carter apart from other presidents that he made a serious attempt to understand these plans?
Well, you'd have to ask him, which I would like to do, but I haven't been able to do yet. He doesn't really say in his memoirs, but he was sensitive to it. For some reason, he understood in his guts what a serious matter this was. And he came into the White House very much alarmed by the situation and with very radical notions about what we might do to make it less dangerous. And circumstances prevented him from carrying out a lot of his hopes and his plans. But he, unlike all other presidents, took very seriously his responsibility for actually authorizing the use of nuclear weapons of war. And he went through the command post exercises that they hold at the White House level on a periodic basis to experience what it would be like to suddenly get the wake-up call at 3 o'clock in the morning and what the decision book actually looked like and the kind of things that he'd be asked to make up his mind about on short notice and to really go through all the drills so that he understood what was involved. And he really did have some understanding of it that was denied other presidents. I think he just was a more serious man, perhaps, about this than his predecessors, or his successors. Yeah?
Proponents of the MX argue that it's needed as a deterrent, but because it's so accurate and also so vulnerable, it seems that its only use would be as a first strike weapon. Do you think that the MX is valuable as a deterrent, or is it only good in the event that the United States wants to launch a first strike?
Well, the military people, I believe, want it because it is a prompt hard target killer. And by prompt, they mean something that's based on land with which you can communicate reliably and quickly. And by hard target killer, they mean something of sufficient accuracy and yield to destroy a hardened target on the ground like a missile silo or something of that kind. And in their thinking about this, they would love to have it survivable. But they haven't seemed to care as much about its survivability as they have about its prompt hard target killing capabilities. And that's what they really wanted out of it. But they're other sort of institutional pressures behind the MX, and I think to some extent they may be lessening and may kill the project in the end. One of them was the Air Force had been promised the next big strategic weapon system. Now nobody else takes that seriously, but they do, and you know, they've been trying to make sure we kept our word. This was a kind of an informal political promise made in Washington, but this was going to be their thing, and they definitely wanted it from that point of view. But its hard target killing capabilities are, I think, soon going to be superseded by the Trident, and so I think some of the institutional pressures relax at that point.
But does a hard target killing capability add to deterrence? I mean, it doesn't seem like that's something you'd want if you only want your nuclear force to be used as a retaliatory strike. Taking out silos is something you want to do in a preemptive strike.
Well, it might be, but it's a mistake to think that there are only two kinds of targets, you know, and one of them is nursing homes and cities, and the other one is silos. You know, there's a bigger range of targets than that, and many of them do require precise targeting and a capacity to hit particular things besides silos. Communication centers, you know, areas where tanks assemble in the event of war and things of that sort. You want to be able to get it right there, you know, and if it's not right there, it doesn't do any good. So there are many uses for accurate land-based weapons besides actually destroying silos. But the essence of the argument from their point of view was the other guys have a capacity to do this, and they have at great expense gone ahead and built weapons and numbers and accuracy that it will enable them to actually attack American weaponry in that kind of a way. And if they do it, we have to be able to respond. Now, if you find yourself in a situation where you really just can't respond with accurate weapons and therefore have to use sort of big, soft lobs at vulnerable places in the Soviet Union, then you're faced with a very unpleasant dilemma. But this would be the argument they would give. You know, I myself think that the MX is absolutely unnecessary and very destabilizing and is dumb to build. Yeah?
You talked to your book, I was suggesting you think the nuclear war is an inevitability. You really believe that, and if not, how do you think it's going to be avoided?
Well, I always get asked that. You know, nobody can predict the future. And I don't know what's going to happen any more than anybody else. But I would say that if you were a disinterested observer and standing at a fair distance from these events and looking at them, you'd be inclined to say that for the last 40 years, the Soviet Union and the United States have looked an awful lot like two powers getting ready to have a big war with each other. And as a disinterested observer, you probably wouldn't be very surprised if it happened. Now, you know, like everybody else, I'm trying to think of ways we might avoid this. And there's a kind of an irresistible temptation to think of it as something like polio. And it's going to have a particular solution, the Salk vaccine. And once we find the solution, you know, it won't be a problem anymore, and it's going to go away. But I don't think that's the right analogy. I think it's a lot more like our capacity to overburden the environment. You know, we do things on such a scale that at any moment, you know, we threaten to poison all the rivers or poison the air or waste all the topsoil or otherwise overburden our environment. And this is a problem that's going to be with us from now on. There's no way to avoid it. You know, you don't save the redwoods just once and then quit worrying about them. You have to save them every year. And you have to save blue whales every year, and you have to keep the rivers clean every year. And these are ongoing problems that are now with us in a permanent kind of way. And our capacity to wage war on a scale that we can't endure is also a problem of that sort. And it has no single solution. My guess is that, you know, future history will be a lot like past history. And, you know, that's a tragic affair, isn't it? And terrible things happen. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's all going to come to an end in one apocalyptic scenario. It could. We've built an instrument that could achieve an end like that. And we have time to think it over before we actually do it. Yeah?
Do you think the nuclear winter in itself has reduced the chance of nuclear war?
Have reduced it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. You know, it's like a poker game where you got to keep upping the ante. We used to be so horrified at the thought that we would destroy half our cities that we thought nuclear war would be impossible. You know, and we became used to that notion and jaded by it. And it certainly didn't inspire us to do anything very, very different about the dealing with the problem. And now it seems to take, you know, an actual threat to the survival of the species before anybody's attention can be, you know, earned. And, you know, I believe that, in fact, we do have the capacity to threaten the species at this point. Whether or not that would be enough, I don't know. The initial response of the Pentagon was, you know, this just goes to show you, you really got to deter war by having lots of them. And, you know, I think in some ways, it has awakened a deeper sense of the dimensions of the problem that we've built for ourselves. But in another way, you know, it can desensitize people and make them feel that it's just too big and it's something beyond what they can handle and that they're just going to give up on. I mean, we all know people, you know, who've been interested in this question for a while, and then they grow weary, and then they grow interested in something else because they just don't feel they can do anything about it. And that can happen in official circles, too. Yeah?
In your writings, you've drawn a parallel between Europe before 1914 and the present day, including the fact that great powers ended grow comfortable with their weapons and just assumed they could go out forever, just building up and never have that. We seem to be in the same rut, especially if you read some of what is it about I published last year. What's the chance of us getting out of that same syndrome? Because you certainly can't get out of that.
Well, I just don't know how to answer that. You know, in terms of chances. People sometimes say, well, what are the chances of a nuclear war before the end of the decade? Well, how do you know that? You know, the chance is zero on the days you don't have it, and it's 100% on the days that you do. And in the same way here, it's very difficult to say, you know, what are the chances of our breaking out of this this pattern of behavior? I can say that all that I know of to use as a weapon is words, and try and talk people out of it. Well, it's very hard to talk people out of something they're really fundamentally and institutionally wedded to doing, you know, and how can you hope for words to do what Hiroshima could not? I mean, there was a dramatic example of what happens, you know, when these weapons get used, and that did not dissuade anybody in the world from building more of them, you know. Many powers went right ahead and did so. The only thing that could do it, I think, is a terrible event in somebody else's country that might have a sort of a sobering and breaking effect on the leaders of ours. And I don't mean just the United States, I mean also the Soviet Union. This is something that they also have to deal with in much the same way that we do, and I suspect that they have the same difficulty in trying to really fess up to the seriousness of the problem and not use it for marginal political gains that are of no serious consequence. How we're going to make people see this really differently, I don't know. And in the absence of knowing how to deal with it in a big way all at once, I think we have to deal with it in a small way, one step at a time, the best way we can see fit to do. I don't know how else to approach it. Yeah? Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, the MX and the Star Wars programs with the Russians are working on. I mean, like, how, you have a little sense of the amount of drain and damage that it's doing to our societies. I mean, like, kind of continuing.
Well, it's doing a lot of damage in some ways, certainly. It's distracting us from things we ought to be doing instead. There's no question about that. I don't think anybody really has a sense of how vast this undertaking is. There's a new book coming out in a few months by William Arkin and Richard Fieldhouse called Nuclear Battlefields, which is a sort of a description of the infrastructure around the world of the nuclear weapons business. It includes not only air bases and missile fields and things of that kind, but storage facilities and research and development centers and weapons designing laboratories and communication centers and stuff, all of which has a direct bearing on nuclear weapons. And you just cannot believe the number of institutions that there are and how widespread they are and how many there are in every state in the Union. It is just awe-inspiring. And they are all over the planet. And the Russians have ones all over their country. It is just quite unbelievable. So in that sense, I would say that preparing to fight a great nuclear war is one of the principal things that the United States and the Soviet Union do, not just as nations, but as whole societies. It is their principal undertaking, common undertaking.
Excuse me, if there are any more questions for Mr. Powers or anyone would like to know more about the November 11th committee, there will be refreshments served right now if you'd like to hang around here. If not, thank you very much.